Superior Court of California, County of Los Angeles, in the matter of the people of the state of California versus Orenthal James Simpson, case number BA097211. We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Nicole Brown Simpson, a human being, as charged in count one of the information.
That was a moment that, for many of us, makes us think back to what we were doing when we heard that verdict come in. For those of you who don't know, that clip was from 1995, when Orenthal James Simpson, or OJ, a former NFL football star and actor, was acquitted of the murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ron Goldman. But even though OJ was found not guilty of the murders, years later, he would find himself in a courtroom again for something so bizarre that even the responding police officer didn't quite believe at first. And this time, there would be a very different outcome. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie. Hi, everyone. There's some big news coming in the trial world this week. O.J. Simpson will be appearing before the parole board to see if he will be released from prison. But I found that a lot of people don't know many of the details surrounding his latest legal troubles. So in light of the parole hearing coming up this week, I thought it would be good to take a look back at the trial that actually landed him in prison. Before we get started, a little background. Now, I know the name O.J. Simpson is practically a household name. Almost everyone has probably heard it before. You might remember him from playing football in the NFL, or maybe even from his acting career. But if you're listening to this podcast, then you probably more notably remember him from his infamous murder trial, where he was acquitted in the Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman murders. But although he was infamously found not guilty in 1995, he didn't exactly stay out of the limelight afterwards. In 1997, OJ was found liable for the murders of Nicole and Ron in a civil trial and was ordered to pay $33.5 million in punitive damages to their families. And then, in 2006, OJ made headlines when he reportedly tried to release a book about the case, titled If I Did It. The book allegedly gives a hypothetical description of the murders. However, the book release was canceled, and in August 2007, a Florida bankruptcy court gave the rights of the book to the Goldman family to partially satisfy the money owed to them from the civil trial. The Goldman family then changed the title to If I Did It, Confessions of the Killer, and included comments by the Goldman family. And then, in September 2007, a now 60-year-old O.J. Simpson popped up in the news again. But this time, it involved another arrest.
12 years after beating a double murder rap, O.J. Simpson is back in handcuffs once again, facing serious charges. After 5 hours of questioning from police Sunday, Simpson was taken to the Clark County Detention Center in Las Vegas, where he will remain until an arraignment later this week. This all stems from an alleged robbery that took place at the Palace Station Casino last Thursday.
A few days earlier, OJ, along with five other men, allegedly stormed into room 1203 at the Palace Station Casino in Las Vegas, and while reportedly armed with firearms, robbed two sports memorabilia dealers. In the 911 call, the men clearly implicate O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, we were just robbed at gunpoint by O.J. Simpson. Can you send police here, please?
Where are you?
What's the name? What room is this?
What room is this? 1203.
O.J. was arrested at the Palms Casino, where he was staying, without incident, and booked on multiple robbery charges. He was let out on bail, and oddly enough, shortly after, If I Did It, Confessions of the Killer became the top seller on Amazon.com. It wasn't long before all the major players in the case were giving their sides of the story to the media. OJ spoke with the Associated Press and told them that he and some others had staged a, quote, sting operation to go to the hotel room and confront some memorabilia dealers so they could get items that had been stolen from him back. He said there were no guns involved and that he had only gone to get mementos that were rightfully his, like his Hall of Fame certificate, personal photos, and the suit he had been wearing when he was acquitted of murdering Nicole and Ron. OJ told the reporter that he didn't call the police about the dealers trying to sell his items because he found them to be unresponsive to him ever since his last trial had ended. He said, "The police, since my trouble, have not worked out for me," adding that whenever he has called them, it just becomes a story about OJ. He also spoke with the Los Angeles Times and told them that it wasn't a robbery. He said, "I'm OJ Simpson. How am I going to think that I'm going to rob somebody and get away with it?" He added, "This is somebody going to get his private belongings back. That's it. That's not robbery." OJ said he had been living in South Florida, but that he had traveled to Las Vegas to attend a wedding. His friend, Thomas Riccio, who owned an auction house, told him that two dealers were selling memorabilia that belonged to him. He said Thomas Riccio then met OJ and the other men in the hotel lobby and then escorted them up to the hotel room. Meanwhile, one of the dealers who was allegedly robbed, Al Beardsley, told TMZ that OJ and five other men, two of whom had guns, had stormed into his hotel room on Thursday night around 8 p.m. He said they left with bags of memorabilia, including photographs and books, along with his own cell phone. He said, "I couldn't believe it, for him to come and do this sort of thing. I don't know what's wrong with OJ." 4 months after his arrest, in January 2008, OJ appeared in court again. This time, he was accused of violating the terms of his bail by allegedly attempting to contact CJ Stewart, his co-defendant in the case. A voicemail was played in court that OJ had left for his bail bondsman back in November. It was laced with profanity and was a message he told the bondsman to deliver to CJ. That same bondsman also told the judge at the hearing that OJ had not yet paid him for the bail from September. Judge Jackie Glass, clearly annoyed, doubled OJ's bail and told the court that she wanted to make sure he paid at least 15% of it before he was to be released. "There's no get-out-of-jail-free card today," she said. She then spoke directly to OJ, accusing him of not taking the matter seriously. She said, "I don't know if it's just arrogance. I don't know if it's ignorance." By the time trial rolled around, Walter Alexander and Michael McClinton, the two men who were holding the guns during the incident, along with the other men, had agreed to cooperate and testify against OJ Simpson and CJ Stewart in exchange for lesser charges. Both OJ and CJ were pleading not guilty, and both were set to be tried in the same trial, beginning on September 15, 2008. By this time, they were each facing a total of 12 counts: conspiracy to commit a crime, conspiracy to commit kidnapping, conspiracy to commit robbery, burglary while in possession of a deadly weapon, two counts of first-degree kidnapping with use of a deadly weapon, two counts of robbery with use of a deadly weapon, two counts of assault with a deadly weapon, and two counts of coercion with a deadly weapon. They were facing possible life sentences if found guilty. In his opening statements, prosecutor Chris Owens began by telling the jury that there was an audio recording of the incident in the hotel room. He said the audio shows threats, force, and the taking of property from the victims in this case. He quoted Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter and said, quote, "No man, for any considerable period, can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which one is true." He told the court that they would spend the next several days finding what may be the true face of Orenthal James Simpson, not the one he tries to put out to the world. Although Judge Jackie Glass had told jurors prior to trial to disregard their feelings about OJ's earlier trials, Owens detailed them in his opening statement, going through the acquittal, the civil trial, and the $33.5 million judgment against him. He told the jury that in the story of O.J. Simpson's life, they would be the ones to write the last chapter. He said a guilty verdict would be a verdict they could feel good about. C.J. Stewart's attorneys jumped up after Owens had finished and argued that O.J.'s past legal troubles were going to affect their client's right to a fair trial, an argument they would make more than 10 times in this trial. But each time, the judge would deny the request to have their client tried separately. O.J.'s attorney, Yale Galanter, told the jury that this case isn't about what happened in California all those years ago, but it's about what happened in Las Vegas. This was a recovery, not a robbery, he said, claiming that the items that had been taken belonged to O.J. and that no crimes had been committed. He stood behind O.J. with his hands on his shoulders and said, "You can think what you want about his past, and you all as jurors have agreed to ignore that. What you're going to hear in this courtroom is not a case about hiding anything from anybody. It's a case about recovering personal items." CJ's attorney, Robert Lucerini, told the jury that CJ was a successful mortgage broker who networked with OJ. He said that on the day of the incident, OJ had asked CJ for help in picking up his property. He told the court that unlike the other men who had been given a deal from prosecutors, CJ was only on trial because he was of no use to the prosecution. He said CJ had no knowledge of the property being stolen and no knowledge of any guns being used. He said that CJ just wants his life back, adding, "It's not if you find him not guilty, it's when you find him not guilty." Bruce Fromong, one of the two memorabilia dealers whose hotel room had been stormed in on, testified that he didn't know that the items had been stolen from O.J. Simpson. He said he had purchased them legally. He identified several items that had been stolen in the sting, including neckties and autographed footballs. He choked up on the stand as he recalled his friendship with O.J., saying that O.J. had even called his mother on her birthday. He described how O.J. burst into his hotel room with a group of armed men and started hollering before leaving with hundreds of collector's items. Fromong told the jury that he had been expecting to meet with an anonymous buyer when the men came in, quote, a military invasion fashion. He said the men stuffed hundreds of items into pillowcases, including items that had nothing to do with O.J. He said once everything was packed up, he told O.J., "Hey, that's my stuff. That doesn't have anything to do with anything." He said one man was pointing a gun at his face and said, "I'll shoot your ass." He told the court that he wasn't cowering in a corner, but that having a gun pointed at him was an uncomfortable feeling. Fromong's cross-examination was pretty aggressive. He admitted that he had discussed the idea of a book with several people and that he had called the TV show Inside Edition before calling police, although he claimed that 911 was already being called at the time. He was also questioned about the fact that he had put up items on eBay afterwards, dubbing them as identical to the items O.J. stole from me. He admitted that in his statement to police, he said O.J. had told the other men, "Get my stuff, leave the other stuff alone." The prosecution also called a shift supervisor at the Palace Station to the stand, who went over surveillance video taken on the day of the incident. A video was played in court showing O.J. and the other men leaving the hotel with pillowcases stuffed with memorabilia. Las Vegas Police Detective Andy Caldwell testified that when he was first called to investigate the alleged robbery, he thought to himself that it couldn't be true, that O.J. Simpson and his friends had robbed two sports memorabilia dealers. He said he only believed it after watching the surveillance video from the Palace Station Hotel, and he could clearly see O.J. leaving with the bags. "I recognized Mr. Simpson instantly," he said. He told the court that when he arrived at the hotel, he found Al Beardsley, Bruce Fromong, and Thomas Riccio, the man who had set up the meeting, and that they were all primarily concerned about the guns that had just been pointed at them. Detective Caldwell said that because O.J. was so well known, he wanted to be careful about how they approached the investigation. He said he spoke with the three men and that all three interviews suggested that O.J. had committed a crime, but he decided to hold off because he wanted to make sure that they had everything right. He said OJ was arrested days later. He told the court that he later learned that Thomas Riccio had secretly recorded the entire incident. He said Riccio never told him about it, but he saw the audio clips on TMZ. He said he then contacted Riccio, who sent him that recording, plus 7 additional recordings, after agreeing to an immunity deal. Detective Caldwell said he spent hundreds of hours listening to the recordings, which Riccio had secretly recorded in OJ's hotel room, around the hotel pool, and while talking to OJ on the phone. Caldwell said a significant amount of the planning had occurred by the hotel pool at the Palms, where OJ was staying. On cross-examination, OJ's attorney, Yale Galanter, brought up a statement that had been secretly recorded, this one of police officers at the scene discussing the case, where one police employee said, "This is great. California can't get him. Now we'll be able to," in reference to OJ's acquittal in California. Caldwell said he didn't hear the remark, and so he couldn't comment on what someone else was thinking. Thomas Riccio also took the stand, and with his testimony came the playing of several audio clips. Riccio testified that in August 2007, another memorabilia dealer, Al Beardsley, contacted him and told him that he had a bunch of memorabilia he was planning on selling that had been stolen from OJ's house. He told him not to tell OJ, but as soon as they hung up, Riccio then called OJ and told him. They decided to stage a sting to get the items back. Riccio recorded numerous conversations of their plans, which he eventually turned over to the police. He said the transcripts the police came up with for the recordings were inaccurate, but that the inaccuracies were nothing major. In one of the recordings, OJ can be heard saying that he wanted the items back because he didn't want them to get into the hands of the Goldman family, calling them gold diggers. As you'll recall, OJ owed more than $33 million to the Goldman family after being found liable for the murder of their son in their civil case. The prosecution also played a recording taken at the Palms pool on September 13, 2007, just hours before the robbery, where most of the planning occurred. At one point, Riccio suggests recording the sting, and OJ replies that that ain't good. Another recording is played, in which you can hear OJ and Riccio talking about their plot and possibly renting a room at the Palace Station. Riccio testified that on the day of the raid, once they got up to the room, Michael McClinton drew his gun and things got crazy. The recording is difficult to make out, but you can clearly hear the chaos as OJ and his friends enter the hotel room. OJ is seemingly the ringleader, yelling, "Think you can steal my shit and sell it?" and "Don't let nobody out of here." He then seems to realize that he knows the two dealers, saying, "I always thought you were a straight shooter."
"I don't let nobody out of this one. I want you to hang that fucking motherfucker. If you can steal my shit and sell it, don't let nobody out of here. You motherfucker. You can steal my shit. Look at this shit. Get over there. You can steal my shit.
I just had to get back alone.
Walk your ass.
You can steal my shit.
Mike took it. I know Mike took it.
Search
it.
I'm going on your side of the room.
Look at you. I always thought you were a straight shooter.
I'm cool. I am.
Riccio testified that he only saw one gun, McClinton's, during the confrontation. He said OJ told Beardsley and Fromong that if they took anything that wasn't his, he would return it to them. After the men left the room, Al Beardsley called 911. The recording resumes and Riccio can be heard saying that OJ was calling him. He gives the phone to Beardsley, who then starts yelling into the phone. Riccio can also be heard on the recording telling the two men that he didn't mean to set them up. Riccio testified that both Beardsley and Fromong had appeared on TMZ before he sold his recording to the site for more than $100,000. As far as the immunity deal he made with police when giving them the tapes, he said his lawyer had wanted to make sure he had immunity, even though he wasn't facing any criminal charges. Two telephone calls were then played for the jury between Riccio and OJ from after the raid. OJ can be heard saying that he was shocked when he heard people say that there was a gun involved in the raid, saying that he didn't see one. Riccio testified that he told the FBI and the Las Vegas Police Department that Beardsley was trying to sell stolen goods, but that his reports had been ignored. He told the court that the objective of the raid was to recover OJ's stolen family heirlooms, not steal other memorabilia. He said everything was going the way it was supposed to, until Michael McClinton pulled out his gun. Charles Ehrlich testified that he and Charles Cashmore went to the raid and were going to pose as buyers. He said he didn't know that the plans had changed. He said he thinks OJ said, "Put the gun away," during the raid, and that afterwards, the gunman put his gun down. After the raid, Ehrlich said that OJ was upset and told his girlfriend, "I fucked up. I'm going to need a bail bondsman." On cross-examination, Ehrlich said that C.J. Stewart was at the meeting at the Palms Pool while the raid was being planned, something that C.J. adamantly denied. Walter Alexander, one of the alleged gunmen who had agreed to testify in exchange for a lesser sentence, said that O.J. had asked him and Michael McClinton to, quote, "bring some heat to the Palace Station so that the guys they were confronting would know they meant business." But although he brought the gun, he claimed he never took it out of his waistband, that Michael McClinton was the one who was pointing his gun at everyone. He said that right before they entered the hotel room, OJ went up to McClinton and told him to put the gun in his hand. After the raid, he said OJ told them not to mention the guns and that the memorabilia they took was worth up to $100,000. He said he and McClinton realized that OJ was going to throw them under the bus. He told the court that he didn't want to see OJ or CJ go to prison. There was also testimony about what was collected through the various search warrants served in the case. Two handguns were found in McClinton's home, both loaded and not locked up. And most of the stolen merchandise was recovered, but 24 baseballs signed by Pete Rose and Duke Snyder had never been found. When Michael McClinton testified, he said that right before they entered the hotel room, OJ told him to take out his gun and to look menacing. He claimed that Alexander had also taken out his gun at one point, which was at odds with Alexander's testimony. Prosecutors played a recording of McClinton and OJ talking at a party just hours after the raid. OJ can be heard saying, "This ain't no major crime," and "You didn't pull the piece out in the hall." OJ then says, in reference to the hotel surveillance video, "There ain't nothing on that video. And look, they're going to look at the video. Ain't nothing they can see. They're going to see us going in the place. Then they're going to see us leaving with just the boxes." McClinton testified that OJ was trying to say that there weren't any guns involved, but that he knew that there were, because he had one of them. So what were OJ's and CJ's defenses to all that? OJ's attorney called one of his friends to the stand, Thomas Scotto, who said that the night after the raid, he was confronted by Michael McClinton and Walter Alexander, and that the two men tried to extort him for $50,000. They told him that the raid went bad and that OJ got them involved in it and that he better call them. He said McClinton also threatened violence against him and everyone else who was involved. And then a voicemail was played from Walter Alexander to Scotto, which said, "If I get some help, I'll do whatever I can. I can do quite a bit." Scotto told the court that he took that as Alexander offering to sell his testimony for money. Scotto also testified that CJ was with him on September 13, 2007, from 2 p.m. until 7 p.m., while the raid was allegedly being plotted. This fell right in line with parts of CJ's defense, which was that he had no part in the planning of it and wasn't there at the Palms Pool that day. CJ's attorney called his cousin Linda to the stand to add to that. She testified that she and CJ had gone to lunch on September 13th when OJ and the others were gathered at the hotel planning the raid. In his closing arguments, prosecutor David Roger called OJ's claims that he never saw any guns during the raid flat nonsense and reiterated their claim that CJ Stewart and OJ Simpson were guilty. OJ's attorney said the case was never about a search for the true facts, that it took on a life of its own because OJ was involved. He then attacked the other men involved in the raid who had testified against OJ and CJ. He said Thomas Riccio called the shots and set up the meeting, and that McClinton couldn't be trusted. He said, "People who commit crimes do not immediately contact the police," and he pointed out that OJ spoke to police after leaving the scene. CJ's attorney said that the court heard more about CJ during opening statements than it did throughout the entire trial. He called the state's witnesses untrustworthy and said the state did not prove their case against CJ. But, as we all know, OJ was found guilty exactly 13 years to the day after he was acquitted of the murders of Nicole and Ron.
District Court, Clark County, Nevada, the State of Nevada Plaintiff versus Orenthal James Simpson, Defendant. Case number C-237-890, Department 5. Verdict. We, the jury, in the above-entitled case, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, as follows. Count 1, conspiracy to commit a crime. Guilty. Count 2, conspiracy to commit kidnapping. Guilty. Count 3, conspiracy to commit robbery. Guilty. Count 4, burglary while...
OJ looked stunned as the verdicts were read. Guilty on all counts. And CJ Stewart was also found guilty of all charges against him. At his sentencing, OJ spoke to the court.
Yes, Your Honor, I stand before you today. Sorry. Somewhat confused. I feel apologetic to the people of the state of Nevada. I've been coming to Nevada since 1959. I worked summer jobs here for my uncle in 60 and 61. And I've been coming ever since, and I've never gotten in any trouble. People have always been fine to me. When I came here for a wedding. I didn't come here to reclaim property. I was told it was here. When he told me that Monday that the stuff was in Nevada, when he knew I was going to be in Nevada, I called my kids. I talked to my sisters. I called the Brown family, and I told them I had a chance to get some of our property back, property that over the years we've seen being sold on the internet. We've seen pictures of ours that were stolen from our home going into the tabloids. We've called the police and asked what to do. They told us what to try to do, but you can never find out who was selling it. And this was the first time I had an opportunity to catch the guys red-handed who had been stealing from my family. And I forgave him, just like I yelled at Bruce and Beardsley. And I've forgiven them. We've talked about it, Beardsley and I, the next day. And Bruce and I have hugged and talked about it. His kids have called me since this. We've apologized to each other. The only person I requested to help me here, was Mr. Stewart. I did request him. I needed his car. I asked him if he had some guys to help me remove these things from the room. I didn't ask anybody to do anything but to stand behind me, allow me to yell at these guys, and then help me remove those things. And if they wouldn't let me remove them, we would call the cops on them. I didn't want to hurt any of these guys. I know these guys. These guys have eaten in my home. I've done book reports with their kids. I sung to their mothers when they were sick. You know, I wasn't there to hurt anybody. I just wanted my personal things, and I realized now I was stupid of me. I am sorry. I didn't mean to steal anything from anybody, and I didn't know I was doing anything illegal. I thought I was confronting friends and retrieving my property. So I'm sorry. I'm sorry for all of it.
After OJ was done speaking, Judge Glass had her turn.
Earlier in this case, at a bail hearing, I asked and I said to Mr. Simpson, I didn't know if he was arrogant or ignorant or both. And during the trial and through this proceeding, I got the answer. And it was both. At the time, not now after you've been locked up for 64 days, but at the time of this event and at the time I saw you at the bail hearing, it was clear to the court that you believed you could do in Las Vegas what you couldn't do elsewhere. You could get your stuff back. Now, there's still questions about whose stuff it is. I think that's still in dispute. You thought it was yours. Your counsel said that over and over to me during the trial and now during the sentencing, as well as you. The tapes, however, in this case, indicated to me when I listened that you didn't want all of those items to fall into the hands of the Goldmans. And you were heard on the tape making reference to them as the gold diggers. That was then. This is now. So you put your group together, and you went to the Palace Station to get those items back. And what you didn't know, and also you, Mr. Stewart, didn't know, was the planning was taped, the event was taped, phone calls were taped, conversations were taped, they had videotape of you going in, they had videotape of you going out, and the party afterwards were taped. Everything in this case was on tape. And it's your own words, Mr. Simpson, your own words that could be heard throughout those events that have brought you here to this seat in my courtroom. Because we heard it all. And what came out on the tapes said to me, and obviously to the jury, that the evidence in this case was overwhelming. It was overwhelming. How often, as a judge, do I sit and listen to a trial and hear everything laid out for me to be able to hear? It's very rare.
She then addressed OJ's apology.
I actually am surprised that I heard from you, Mr. Simpson. I had believed that there wasn't going to be a statement from you, and I was going to be concerned about your lack of responsibility for this action. And it's kind of a fine line in what you said to me. I hear what you said and what Mr. Galanter said, which is, I didn't intend to do anything wrong, so I must not have done something wrong, so there was no criminal intent. It was just all stupidity. I have to tell you now, it was much more than stupidity. And it's very rare that I have somebody talking to me at a sentencing about mens rea and criminal intent. It really doesn't matter. You went to the room. You took guns, meaning you and the group. You used force. You took property, whether it was yours or somebody else's. And in this state, that amounts to robbery with use of a deadly weapon.
And then, finally, Judge Glass addressed OJ's past.
When I first started this trial and I talked to the jury when we had the whole panel in, I stated to the group that if they were here because they wanted to punish Mr. Simpson for what had happened previously, then this wasn't the case for them. And I meant that. As the judge in this case, I'm not here to sentence Mr. Simpson for what's happened in his life previously in the criminal justice system. As a judge who presides in courtrooms, in this courtroom every day, and over trials, hundreds of trials during the 6 years I've been here, I have great respect for the criminal justice system. I'm part of it. And as a judge who has taken jury verdicts for years, I respect the verdicts of my juries. I have to respect what happened in the case 13 years ago with Mr. Simpson. The jury decided. There are many people who disagree with that verdict, but that doesn't matter to me.
The judge ordered 8 of the 10 counts to run concurrently, with a maximum sentence of 33 years. He would be eligible for parole after 9 years, in 2017, which brings us to this week. The other men charged in the case, Walter Alexander, Charles Ehrlich, Charles Cashmore, and Michael McClinton, were all sentenced to probation. After serving about 2 years in prison, C.J. Stewart's conviction was overturned by the Supreme Court, who said that O.J.'s fame tainted his chances for a fair trial and that he should have been tried separately. In order to avoid a retrial, C.J. took a plea deal for felony robbery and conspiracy. However, he was released and didn't have to serve another day in prison. And in May 2013, O.J. got a chance at a new trial. He returned to the Clark County District Court for a 5-day hearing where he testified before a judge about his former attorney, Yale Galanter. In his 94-page petition for a new trial, O.J. claimed that he received such poor representation at trial that he deserved a new one. For one, O.J. said that Galanter actually knew about O.J.'s plan to confront the dealers and get his stuff back in advance. In fact, he said that he and Galanter had dinner together the night before, and that Galanter told him that he was well within his legal rights, as long as he didn't trespass on private property, and as long as he didn't use physical force. Then, at trial, he said that Galanter told him that he didn't need to testify because prosecutors hadn't proved their case. O.J. said he was never told that prosecutors offered a plea deal, which would have given him a minimum of 2 years in prison, an offer he said that he would have accepted. But at the hearing, Yale Galanter took the stand, and because O.J. had waived his attorney-client privilege, Galanter was able to respond to the accusations. He said O.J. had confided in him that guns had been brought to the hotel room, telling Galanter that he messed up. Galanter also testified that he did go to dinner the night before the robbery with O.J., and that O.J. mentioned that he was planning on retrieving his stuff through a sting operation. But when he said this, Galanter said he asked O.J., "What are you doing?" and told him to call the police instead. He testified that O.J. never told him that, quote, he was going to go to the Palace Station Hotel with a bunch of thugs, kidnap people, and take property by force. To insinuate I, as a lawyer and officer of the court, would have blessed it is insane. And with regard to the plea deal that O.J. said Galanter never told him about, Galanter said he always tells his clients about plea deal offers. He said that, in fact, during the trial, he did tell O.J. about the prosecution's offer of 2 to 5 years, and that O.J. had him go back to them and counter with a 1-year deal, which the DA immediately refused. He said there were no other offers or counters aside from that. O.J. was not granted a new trial, but just a few months after the hearing, in July 2013, he won another small victory. He appeared in front of a parole board and was deemed eligible for parole on some of his charges, but not all of them, yet. He still had an additional 4 years to serve for the 4 weapons-related sentences and the 2 counts of assault with a deadly weapon. And that brings us to July 20th, 2017, O.J.'s next scheduled parole hearing. What are the chances of O.J. getting out? Well, pretty likely, according to Steve Wolfson, the Clark County District Attorney, who noted that O.J. is 70 years old now and was essentially a model prisoner while serving his time. If parole is granted, O.J. could be released as early as October 1st, 2017. And that's all for this episode. But before I go, I do have a rather large announcement regarding the case I covered back in episode 4. As you might recall, 19-year-old Praveen Varagase, a student at Southern Illinois University, died under mysterious circumstances back in February of 2014. And while the cause of death was initially ruled hypothermia, Praveen's family has always been adamant that he was murdered. Well, there's been an arrest in the case. A local man named Gage Bethune, who I also discussed in the episode, was just charged with first-degree murder in Praveen's death. I'll hopefully have an update episode about the case coming shortly, but in the meantime, if you haven't yet listened to episode 4, I would love it if you did. Praveen's case is one that really hit home for me, and one that I've been invested in since I very first heard about it. And if you want to discuss Praveen's case, or any others, you can go to our Facebook discussion group, which you can get to directly by going to courtjunkie.com/Facebook. How was that segue? You can also find me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod and on Instagram at courtjunkie. You can also support this podcast by going to courtjunkie.com/support, and that will lead you to my Patreon page, where you can donate as little as $1 a month and get access to early ad-free episodes. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.